As U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken wraps up an overseas trip focusing on Ukraine, what's a key takeaway from the diplomatic effort?
A rumble in the background of tensions that's emerged with the leading European countries starting to talk a lot more about a diplomatic end to the war.
Plus, a new study emerges analyzing Russian military tactics in Ukraine.
According to ISW, this basically proves quite a significant tactical mistakes in that area.
And later in the program, an update on efforts to save and preserve Ukraine's cultural heritage sites. Today is Monday, May 16th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Nordic countries Finland and Sweden have been strongly considering applying for NATO membership. And on Sunday, May 15th, they took their considerations a step further. Reuters' Christy Kilburn starts us off.
Finnish President Sauli Niinistö confirmed that Finland would apply to join NATO, while Sweden's ruling Social Democrats announced an official policy change that could pave the way for Sweden's application in the coming days. If Sweden does not apply, they would be the only Nordic outsider. Other Nordic countries like Norway, Denmark, and Iceland joined the pact as founding members. Finland and Sweden would like guarantees that NATO member nations would defend them while the application process is underway. Finland's president spoke to Russian President Vladimir Putin on Saturday and said their conversation did not contain any threats, despite Moscow repeatedly warning of serious consequences if the nations join NATO. Ratification can take a year as parliaments of all 30 NATO countries need to approve new members. However, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says arrangements for the interim period can be made.
We will try to speed up that process as much as possible. Many allies have stated that they will find fast tracks, as for instance Germany has indicated that this can go quite fast. We will look into ways to provide security assurances, including by increasing NATO presence in the region, in the Baltic region, in and around Finland and Sweden.
While many member nations such as Britain, Germany, and the United States are showing support, Turkey is holding back. Turkey surprised its allies in recent days by saying it had reservations about Finnish and Swedish membership due to their support of Kurdish militant groups present on their territory. On Sunday, in a meeting with foreign ministers in Berlin, Turkey said in order to support their memberships, the Nordic nations must halt Kurdish militant support, as well as lift bans on some sales of arms to Turkey. Sunday's meeting seemed promising, as Turkey's foreign minister said talks with Swedish and Finnish counterparts were helpful. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken echoed those remarks.
I don't want to characterize the specific conversation that we had either with the foreign minister or within the NATO sessions themselves. But I can say this much. I heard almost across the board very strong support for Finland and NATO joining the alliance if that's what they choose to do. And I'm very confident that we will reach consensus on that.
Christy Kilburn of Reuters News. Now, once vetted by NATO allies and if Turkish objections are met, approval for Finland could come in a matter of weeks. Those in Moscow are giving mixed responses on Monday when asked about plans by Finland and Sweden to join the NATO military alliance. One person told Reuters News that Russia should mind its own business and that there was really nothing to do. And another said Moscow should be cautious, adding that it felt like Russia was being surrounded on all sides. Russia also said on Monday that the West should have no illusions that Moscow would simply put up with the Nordic expansion of the U.S.-led NATO to include Sweden and Finland, casting the move as a mistake that would stoke military tension. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrived in Abu Dhabi on Monday after leaving Paris, where he had a working dinner with his French counterpart. The State Department said that the two top diplomats discussed issues of importance in the bilateral relationship, especially the urgent need to confront global food insecurity exacerbated by the Russian war in Ukraine and other topics. Blinken's first stop in his overseas tour was in Berlin, where he met with the Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba on Sunday. They also discussed plans to work together to ensure that Ukrainian food exports reach consumers both in Africa and Asia. Berlin hosted a meeting of NATO foreign ministers called to discuss the situation on the ground in Ukraine and to coordinate efforts to provide Ukraine with the humanitarian assistance and weapons it needs to defend itself against Russia. As the secretary's trip nears its conclusion, I asked Jason Davidson, a political science and international affairs professor at the University of Mary Washington, which is located in Fredericksburg, Virginia, what the key takeaways were from the trip.
Yeah, well, I think the first thing to note is that it looks like the process moving forward of bringing Finland and Sweden into NATO is moving forward. There was a bit of a glitch with Turkey, but it looks like that's going to be something that they'll be able to iron over. I know the second thing that comes to mind is the really continued striking NATO consensus in general, both to bolster the alliance's defenses relative to Russia, but also the support for Ukraine, both in terms of aid, military and otherwise. And then, of course, the sanctions against Russia, so efforts to weaken Russia there. Maybe the third thing that I would sort of draw attention to is a rumble in the background of tensions that's emerged with the leading European countries starting to talk a lot more about a diplomatic end to the war, and the United States seeming so far to be really firmly backing Ukraine in a slightly more staunch or firm.
So what kind of implications could this have moving forward, not only for the U.S. and Europe relations, but the conflict in general?
I think it's not completely clear yet, and probably won't be clear for a little while, because part of what's going to be affecting all of this is what happens on the battlefield. Right. That's what's made Ukraine, I think, start to talk about these things and really has brought the subject to the fore, you know, for them to start really bringing up this question consistently of return to the 2014 borders. Certainly they had it in mind previously, but it's become a lot more realistic as they've been able to make more progress and the Russians have consistently failed. So the first thing to note is that there's going to have to be continued progress in that direction. But I really think in the end, as long as they stay firm, as long as Zelensky stays firm, the United States is going to support Zelensky. And then I suspect that the leading European countries, France, Germany, and Italy are probably going to have to sort of support Zelensky because he's got the moral argument on his side.
You know, a few moments ago, you brought up Turkey and their sort of objection to Finland joining NATO and efforts to smooth that over. If Turkey gets the assurances that it's seeking, what kind of implication would that have for the alliance moving forward?
So, yeah, it's a really good question. There certainly have been instances in the past where NATO members, you know, one NATO member country has had an objection, and they're often able to iron things out diplomatically behind closed doors. So I don't think there's something extraordinary here. Now, if Turkey were to actually, which is, you know, they've said pretty much that they're not going to do this, but if they were to put a firm like veto hold on this entry, that would be a pretty big shocker. But just extracting some kind of minor concessions. And the other thing to even think about in terms of the concessions, which we've seen both with NATO expansion, but also with EU enlargement, is you can ask for something and the country can agree to it. But once they're in the alliance, a country like Turkey loses its leverage because then, you know, all bets are off in terms of, you know, any ability to influence that country's behavior moving forward. So I don't think there's a real problem here in terms of the future of the alliance. I also don't think that there's any real alternative, any additional allies that the alliance would be considering taking on in with anything like the haste of Sweden and Finland. In both cases, they've got some very special characteristics, both in terms of their geographic position on the Baltic Sea, but also the fact that they both have very advanced militaries and they've done a lot of cooperation with NATO up until this point.
Political science and international affairs professor at the University of Mary Washington, Jason Davidson, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Ukraine said on Monday that its forces had pushed back Russian troops in the Kharkiv region in a counteroffensive that allowed the Ukrainians to reach the Russian border. In addition, Ukraine's military said that the Russian forces had focused their latest attacks on the Donetsk region in the east, targeting civilian and military sites in multiple towns. VOA has not been able to independently confirm these claims. Now, to learn more about what's being reported, I spoke with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
Early in the morning, Russian troops launched missile strikes on the Odessa region. As a result of the strategic aviation planes strikes, there were damages of tourist infrastructure, and also quite a lot of buildings were destroyed in that area. So again, Russian forces attacked an already damaged and non-functioning bridge across the Dniester estuary. They attacked it a couple of times already last week and the week and previous week as well. It's a strategic breach. But instead of, you know, damaging the breach again, the missiles reached the civilian areas. For the moment, we know that four people were injured, and this including a child who was quite seriously injured. This is again, for the moment. So we are having some updates soon as well. Also, we know that at least six private buildings were destroyed this morning in Odessa region. In terms of the city of Odessa, there were also explosions heard. What was confirmed by the Ukrainian officials, it was air defense in action, and air defense destroyed the X type of cruise missile, which was directed to the city of Odessa.
And we should note that is information coming from the Ukrainian government, which VOA has not been able to independently verify. And I also want to ask you about this, a new study released by the Institute for the Study of War about some of the Russian tactics used last week. What did the report say?
The Institute for the Study of War are working a lot discovering a lot of cases in this war. Last week, it was a very, interesting case, I should say, which happened on May 11 in Bilohorivka. We also talked about that last week. It's a little city in Luhansk region. What happened there is that Ukrainian forces covered Russian army with a couple of strikes while Russian army was trying to cross the Dniester. What happened is that Russian army, according again to the study, the Russian army lost 485 servicemen out of 550 cents there. So basically 88% of all the servicemen that they've sent. And this also in addition to 80 units, at least 80 units of Russian equipment, because this is only what satellites could show. According to ISW, this basically proves quite a significant tactical mistakes in that area. And also Ukrainian officials confirming that in this area, in Luhansk and Donetsk area, there are quite a lot of tactical mistakes, unexpected mistakes done by Russian forces.
You know, speaking of the Donetsk and Luhansk region over there, the Donbas, there's also enhanced fighting in and around Sumy. What's the latest update according to the Ukrainian government?
Area of Sumy, which was liberated completely together with Kyiv region almost in the same time, suffered another attack this morning. In the morning, it was a fire on the territory of the Sumy region from the territory of Russian Federation. So it was an attack by saboteurs who tried to enter the territory of Ukraine, a couple of groups. Ukrainian border guards, the guards forced them to retreat beyond the state border. In this battle that was going on in the morning, one Ukrainian border guard was killed.
Anna, in the time that we have left, really quickly, what's the latest on efforts to extricate the Mariupol Azovstal Steel Ironworks defenders from that facility? There were reports last week of UN, ICRC, and others trying to mediate an evacuation plan.
Unfortunately, there is no particular result yet. So the negotiations are going on. And what we know that Ukrainian side gave a full mandate to the UN and to the Red Cross. And Ukrainian side is open for the third country to help to save the defenders of Mariupol. But unfortunately, for the moment, we don't have official confirmation or any information on any progress and any confirmations from Russian side in terms of evacuation. What we know as an update that on Saturday, Russian forces for the first time used either incendiary or phosphorus bombs. And this was confirmed by Russians themselves. Russian forces claim that they actually used incendiary shells with termite layers, which are almost impossible to stop burning, and the burning temperature is 2,000 degrees of Celsius. The shelling is intensifying big time over the weekend. Azovstal was under severe attack from the sea, from the air, and from the land.
Anna Chernikova, reporting for us from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Vast swaths of farmland in Ukraine are now occupied by Russian troops, and that's contributing to a food crisis in countries around the world. Ukrainian farmers say that working in their fields is now like playing Russian roulette, and as a result, the United Nations says countries relying on those crops face possible starvation. VOA's Heather Murdoch brings us this story.
Along the highways in Zaporizhia, Ukrainian billboards say things like, "Put your Molotov cocktail here," with pictures of red arrows pointing to sensitive spots on Russian tanks. In recent weeks, strikes on the city have become more common. And in the Zaporizhia countryside, Russia controls 85% of the oblast's farmland after more than 2 months of war.
These fields are about 30 kilometers from the front lines where the Russian military is stationed. Farmers here say they are littered with the remnants of missiles from attacks.
Ukrainian farmers wear body armor, hoping the fields will stay safe enough to work, at least through the harvest over the next 2 months.
Sometimes missiles hit fields. Other fields are impossible to reach because they're in the occupied territory. The war has made our job extreme.
Ukraine and Russia together produce more than a quarter of the world's wheat, as well as other major food items like barley, sunflower seed oil, and corn. The war in Ukraine has strained food supplies and increased prices across the globe. In the worst hit, poorest, and most war-torn countries, like Yemen, Ethiopia, and Afghanistan, many people could soon face starvation in part due to the war in Ukraine, according to the United Nations. Regional officials say Zaporizhia, one of Ukraine's top growing regions, usually produces 2.7 million tons of wheat, mostly for export, but this year expects only about 260,000 tons. Most of it will stay in Ukraine. Next year could be even scarcer, officials add. Without cash from the current crop for fertilizers, gas, insecticides, and other farming needs.
Farmers do not have enough capital right now to invest in future crops. They have grain, but they cannot sell it. How can they operate without money? Banks are giving limited loans, but we are under martial law. They are being cautious.
The immediate problem for global food supplies is that attacks have shut down major ports and train lines in Ukraine. The remaining rail and road routes cannot carry enough food far enough. And farmers say as the war intensifies in eastern Ukraine, even supplies to feed Ukraine and its military could be at risk.
We can't tell what will happen tomorrow. If Russian occupiers come here, they could take our lands. They could ruin the fields. It's a huge risk. It's high stakes, like playing Russian roulette.
He says if Ukrainian farmers lose this game, the results could be catastrophic for global food needs and apocalyptic for Ukrainian farming communities. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Zaporizhia, Ukraine.
As of mid-May, UNESCO had verified damage to at least 120 cultural sites in Ukraine. To preserve the country's cultural heritage, organizations such as UNESCO, Blue Shield Denmark, and American IT are inviting civilians to help preserve their nation. VOA's Russian service rounds us out.
This is what's left of the Mariupol Drama Theater that was built in 1960, now destroyed by Russian bombs. And there is much more damage, according to UNESCO, which seeks to promote peace through culture. The UN organization says as of mid-May, Russian troops in Ukraine had destroyed 54 religious sites, 11 museums, 15 monuments, 7 libraries, 26 historical buildings, and 14 cultural centers. To help save what's left, UNESCO is working with Blue Shield Denmark, an international organization created to preserve cultural heritage amid military conflicts and natural disasters. The goal is to make 3D models and copies of Ukrainian cultural buildings, sites, and artifacts.
Being able to rebuild some of the most important buildings could actually be a symbol for a better future. And this app will help preserving as many buildings and monuments as possible.
The project is called Backup Ukraine and came to life with the help of American IT specialists from Polycam, a special smartphone app that serves as a 3D scanner.
If you're getting a building, you have to start in one corner and then move around to the other corner so you can get it from all the different perspectives. It fuses the images together into one 3D model of exactly what you were looking at.
A few dozen 3D images and copies have already been completed, but volunteers taking the pictures must be cautious.
You're like exposing yourself to the elements of a zone that could be, you know, in the middle of a war. And then B, people might be suspicious of somebody capturing lots of photographs of an outdoor building or a statue. So for those folks, we wanted to make sure that there's some kind of vetting process.
Volunteers in Ukraine are also helping save their country's precious artwork. Katerina Buchatsky, who was born in Kyiv, took a break from her studies at Stanford University in the U.S. after the war started. She co-founded the Shadows Project, which she says is helping museums get protective equipment from abroad.
We've been working closely with the National Museum in Lviv, and the first time I went there, they showed us around. They had already taken down all of the art and all of the artifacts and essentially moved it to the basement.
Nonprofit groups say saving art and models of the country's architecture is critical for post-war Ukraine.
In the aftermath of war and trying to rebuild society and trying to find your way back into some kind of normal life, cultural heritage is incredibly important.
And while normal life in Ukraine seems little more than a memory now, damaged cultural sites live forever in digital memory and maybe one day as rebuilt sites in a nation at peace. For VOA's Russian service, VOA News, Washington.
And that's going to do it for us today. Stay up to date with our continuing coverage of Ukraine, as well as news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms. Just follow at VOA News. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.